This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We have two bills on the agenda, and we're going to start with Senate File 515, Senator Berglund's bill.
Chairman and members of the committee, I do have an office amendment, the A1 amendment.
And that is in the packets.
Right. And the amendment just would indicate that these peer specialists that the bill would help to certify would be at least 21 years of age and have a high school diploma or its equivalent.
Senator Berglund moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman and members, this bill will do something that I thought we actually had done already in our law. And we actually, in our laws already for a number of our community-based services, allow some of the services or part of the team to consist of a mental health peer specialist. But we don't have very many mental health peer specialists. And I think part of the reason for that is because we don't really have a way for people to have a career track in this particular area. And so this bill would create a certification process for people who want to be in the mental health field as a certified peer specialist. Studies have shown that consumer-run services and consumer providers can broaden access to mental health services and, in some cases, great help to get more compliance with the mental health treatment that is needed for an individual. It's possible that mental health peer specialists could be able to speak the same language that the person who is in need of the mental health services would speak. It is possible that that person, having had mental health experiences themselves, can help someone to understand when they're going through a hard time how they can get through that and back to a better outcome for themselves. So that's one of the reasons that I have sponsored this bill. In the year 2000, Georgia was the first state in the country to provide peer support services as a Medicaid reimbursable service. It was followed then by Arizona, and since then, at least six other states have adopted this type of approach, including Washington, Michigan, Virginia, South Carolina, and Pennsylvania. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to call on the witnesses that are here for the bill. I think they can speak much more eloquently to the need for this bill and the success of this type of person being part of the mental health team.
Thank you. Senator Berglund, you want to call on the witnesses?
Yes.
In whatever order you would like to.
Maureen Marin.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, sir, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Maureen Marin. I'm the Executive Director of the Mental Health Consumer Survivor Network. The Mental Health Consumer Survivor Network supports peer-to-peer support for many reasons. As the only consumer organization in this state, we have personal experience with the powerful benefits that come from interactions with people having similar struggles while achieving their personal recovery goals. The President's New Freedom Commission on Mental Health final report in 2003 states that recovery-oriented services and supports are often successfully provided by consumers through consumer-run organizations and by consumers who work as providers in a variety of settings, such as peer support and psychosocial rehabilitation programs. The New Freedom Commission report goes on to state, studies show that consumer-run services and consumer providers can broaden access to peer support, engage more individuals in traditional mental health services, and serve as a resource in the recovery of people with psychiatric diagnosis. To those of us living with psychiatric diagnosis, this is much more than a report. This is truth. Peer support is not unique to people with mental illness, much the opposite. Peer support is a natural human response to being labeled, isolated, oppressed, and discriminated against. Rooted in compassion, the instinct to help or be helped by peers is perennial in humans' history. However, the legacy of peer support for people with psychiatric diagnosis, although there is organized evidence found back as far back as 1830, is largely anecdotal with a scarcity of recorded published data. This, I believe, is a direct result of the debilitating stigma that has so infiltrated our society and our very beings. With many of those erroneous beliefs centered around the inability of people with mental illness to contribute to their own well-being, let alone assisting others. Mental illness ranks first among illnesses that cause disability in the United States. However, far too many Americans fail to receive services or have access to recovery-oriented services. Since the 1970s, consumer-operated services, including peer support, have matured, diversified, and increased across the United States. Part of that maturation process has been studies measuring outcomes of the benefits of peer support services. Much knowledge and early evidence of the importance of peer support services comes out of accounts written by persons with mental illness. In these writings, the processes and outcomes of consumer-operated services, including peer support, are documented, laying the groundwork for future quantitative studies. Sally Zinman, the executive director of the California Network of Mental Health Clients, wrote, "Peer support demystifies our emotional life, giving back to us the knowledge and tools to help ourselves. Our emotional life is no longer somebody else's. We are no longer the medical professional's specialty. We are the experts." In the oral histories conducted as part of the Well-Being Project in 1989, many consumer leaders discussed the value of peer support programs in reducing psychiatric problems, building empowerment, building personhood, and increasing social connectedness. As Senator Berglund referred to, Georgia was the first state to provide peer support services in 2000. In Minnesota, we have the opportunity to, using the language from the most well-known peer support organization, that of AA, take what we need and leave the rest. All of those states that Senator Berglund referred to have incorporated a certified peer specialist program to provide a wider array of recovery services to people with mental health diagnosis. The importance of peer services is not unique to those of us with psychiatric diagnosis. All similarities, common obstacles, or achievements are spread through modeling, mentoring, and sharing personal experiences. This is what people do. What is unfortunately unique for those of us with mental illness is that our humanity is stripped away by illness, our personalities are defined as symptoms, and our lives are limited by diagnosis. But it does not have to be that way, and it is time for Minnesota to take the lead in ensuring that those ingrained damaging beliefs are challenged and changed. Just as a person grieving the loss of a loved one is comforted and lent hope by others who have lost, in the same way, a cancer survivor shares the journey with someone newly diagnosed, and a veteran parent shares their experience with the unsure new parent, it is time that people with mental illnesses are afforded the same human opportunity to heal, stumble, recover, make mistakes, and change their mind, because that is what we all do, no matter what the obstacles or issues that confront us. Peer support is offering what any and all of us need at various times for various reasons. It is time that those of us with psychiatric diagnosis have the same opportunity to live and share a life defined by our humanity as opposed to our illness. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to call on Nancy Holton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for this opportunity to talk to you about the peer-to-peer support bill. My name is Nancy Holton, and I am the clinic manager for Ramsey County Mental Health Center. We're in a partnership with Consumer Survivor Network to provide peer-to-peer support services through their Milestones program. And let me tell you why we think that's important within our center. We know that peer-to-peer support provides a couple of things that professionals, mental health professionals, cannot provide. One of the most important things that peers can provide is that hope, that intangible, difficult to define, but easily recognizable hope for recovery. It is a much easier leap for people to make when they see someone who says, I've been there, I've recovered, you can too, to grab onto the hope that offers than when a mental health professional says those same words. There's a magic to a peer saying those same words. And finally, there's an incredible magic to an individual who's able, through support and friendship, to give a message to a fellow journey along the road to recovery that a professional can't give. And let me tell you a brief story about that. I was running a support group for individuals recovering from mental illness, and I've been talking to one of the members about how going off of her medication was a problem for her, and I was talking about it in terms of the increase of symptoms that she was experiencing. I wasn't getting very far. A member of the group said to her, you know, when you're off your medication, you talk pretty crazy, and I don't like you as much as when you're on your medication and you're a friend to me. That evening, she went back on her medication. I'd been talking to her for weeks. There's a very powerful message that comes from a peer-to-peer support perspective that is not the same as one that comes from a mental health professional. So I strongly support this bill. It gives us a tool and a pathway for peer-to-peer specialists to work alongside mental health professionals to aid in the recovery from mental illness. Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Holton, I have a lot of questions going on in my mind, and I agree with you about how important peer support is, but that's in a therapeutic relationship. And I'm trying to figure out how you would use paid peer support, and if it doesn't lose its value then, if then the people that are providing the support are paid for a service, how would they function within an organization?
With the partnership, I use us as an example. The Milestones program essentially co-locates in the Mental Health Center. We give them a physical space. They run a class every day, and then they also do individual peer-to-peer support. In that class, they teach wellness recovery action planning. And as they go through that curriculum, which is a fairly formal curriculum, they're teaching people skills that they need in order to figure out their recovery journey. And then they meet with them individually, and they tell stories, and they help them do individual problem solving. They may accompany them to appointments or to teach them how to use the bus, get to other places in the community that they need to access in order to make that plan happen. It works extremely well in our setting.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Holton, how does that differ then from like an ACT team?
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to say to Senator Prettner-Solon that in some of the ACT teams, peer mental health specialists are a member of the team. It isn't happening all over. It isn't happening in every case, but it is happening in some cases, and it's been pretty successful.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, we already have this peer support available within Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Prettner-Solon, many of our community-based services, the statutes were written in such a way that they envisioned being able to use supportive personnel that are not licensed mental health professionals. What's missing is the piece of how the system gets those people into their service delivery program. And that's what this bill should help us to do. I don't expect that the bill will have much cost beyond the fact that we need to get some way to actually certify people to be peer specialists.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, how does it differ then from an unlicensed mental health professional?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pretner Solon, this has been always envisioned as being part of a continuum of the care. An unlicensed mental health worker is not necessarily working as part of a continuum of care. Unlicensed mental health workers are people that we, it's a category we had for people when we didn't know what else to call them because they were not licensed. But this bill would create a certification program for these individuals. We do pay other people in the system today who are not necessarily licensed professional mental health people.
Mr. Chair, I think that an unlicensed mental health professional needs to have at least a bachelor's degree. And I'm concerned when I see the, what is it, 30 hours? 30 hours of specialty training that, I'm not sure where it is now.
Let me do a little clarification on the unlicensed mental health practitioner and professional and mental health worker. There are three levels of mental health workers within the system, starting with individuals who are not, do not currently have a bachelor's degree. And then we have those who have bachelor's degrees and then those who have advanced degrees. So we have several different categories. What we do not have is a pathway to recognize the unique skills and qualifications that peer-to-peer support can bring. This formalizes that not only in a title, but also gives us a certification and credentialing process so that we can feel confident that they're coming into our mental health delivery system with some basic tools that they need to be able to be effective team members.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to figure out why this category couldn't fit into existing categories currently than if we already have a category for unlicensed mental health professionals who don't have bachelor's degrees. And I get concerned about the peer-to-peer program and how that might further stigmatize people. And what happens then when they are seeking their own mental health care, and what conflicts of interest might occur if they participate in a group situation? And how do you find the boundaries between those different areas? I see this much differently than I do in an addictions model of programming where there's peer-to-peer support.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me specifically talk about that last piece. One of the things that we learned from Arizona, who has a peer-to-peer support specialist field, is that you can develop a curriculum that specifically addresses things like how do you maintain your boundaries, where do you go for help, and how do you remain in the helper role within the employment setting as opposed to when you're getting help for yourself personally. So there's an established curriculum that individuals go through to become certified as specialists that is recognized, and that gives mental health professionals and the mental health delivery system confidence in the individual's ability to function effectively as a part of that team.
But Mr. Chair and Ms. Holton, boundaries is one of the most difficult issues to address. And even in those who have a doctoral degree, there are often questions about where those boundaries are. And I would think it would be very, very difficult in a mental health illness where people struggle with boundaries anyways to be able to train people with, is it 30 hours of training? I can't find it right now. That is required in order for them to qualify for this type of a certification.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pretner Solon, I'd like to read to you from our existing rehab Rehabilitation Mental Health Act. A mental health rehabilitation worker. A mental health rehabilitation worker means a staff person working under the direction of a mental health practitioner or mental health professional and under the clinical supervision of a mental health professional in the implementation of rehabilitative mental health services as defined in the recipient's individual treatment plan, who is at least 21 years of age, has a high school diploma or equivalent, and has successfully completed 30 hours of training during the past 2 years in the following areas. And so the way in which this is different from that is that this person also has to be a person that's in recovery with a mental health diagnosis. Otherwise, we allow this. We haven't gotten very many of these people involved, but I think that if we go this route and have a certification program for peer specialists, we will see more of this type of rehabilitation mental health worker being used in our existing programs.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, were you reading from the requirements for the peer specialist or from the my question is, why create something specific that is this? It is the same except for the mental health diagnosis. Why not allow them to be?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Solon, I think the reason that we haven't seen more people that would meet the definition of mental health peer specialists being used in the statutes where they are allowed to be used is because of the stigma. People who have mental illness. And I believe that this bill will help to overcome that stigma by giving people a way in which they can be recognized as legitimate workers and legitimate contributors and legitimate parts of the team.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, they already can do that without having to even identify as being mentally ill. They could provide the same type of skills. They can be certified under the unlicensed mental health provider and not have to even carry the label of mental illness with them. This then stigmatizes them by saying they are a person in recovery, and in order to qualify, they have to have mental illness.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Pretner Solon, no one is going to be required to do this. No one has to come forward and, you know, go through the training to be a mental health peer specialist. But in other states that have allowed this, it has worked very well. It has been very successful, and it has helped many people with mental illness who are able to have someone who also has suffered a mental illness to be their peer specialist, to be in a better place in their own recovery. And so, you know, this isn't like we're inventing the wheel ourselves here. We're taking something that's worked pretty well in a number of other states.
Senator Pretner, so I was going to say that when you were saying you're concerned about stigmatizing the person, I picture one of the best things you can do if you have mental illness and you are able to help somebody else as a peer specialist, I picture that would be the opposite of stigmatizing you. It would make you feel that despite your illness, you are able to help somebody else in a similar illness.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, except that they're already able to do it under current law.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pretner Solon, then it wouldn't hurt to go ahead and do this approach. We even though it's allowed under current law, we don't have very many people who would actually be a peer specialist who are provide any role in the recovery of other people and their mental illness.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'm going to say this out loud just because I feel like it's exploiting people with mental illness. I think that they can be treated as part of mainstream culture. They qualify to be be credentialed without having to use their diagnosis as a criteria.
Mr. Chairman, I guess all I can say is that folks that are here today from the Survivor Network don't feel like that. They feel like this would be very helpful to them and to many of the people in their organization.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will readily admit I do not know as much about this topic as I should. And in hearing the discussion between Senator Solon and Senator Berglund, I'm probably a little more confused than I was before. Can someone explain to me what someone will be allowed to do under this bill that they are not allowed to do now?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, the main thing would be that we would have a pathway and a mechanism for a person who has a mental illness to be trained and then certified as a peer specialist. Doesn't allow them to do any more than the statutes already allow them to do, but it would be a way for people with mental illness to be able to find their way into the mental health system as a part of that system and a part of providing help to other people with mental illness in that system.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On a very elementary level, how different is this from someone that has gone through AA mentoring someone else coming into AA? They're not licensed and they don't have a title, but they certainly serve as mentors. Is this something much deeper or more involved than that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, I think the major difference is that this person that's described in this bill would have a relationship with the other members of that individual's mental health teams. So they wouldn't be off mentoring or helping somebody without being part of the mental health team of professionals that are also working with that individual.
Senator Wergen.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, so then under what you're proposing, that mental health peer specialist would then be included in all of the data privacy of the person that they're mentoring, so to speak, or is there still some separation there?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, I think that would depend on what would depend on the individual with the mental illness and what the team that they're working with feels is necessary to share with that mental health peer professional, peer specialist. It doesn't mean they'd have access to all their medical records necessarily, no. But it does mean that they would be, you know, if they saw that someone that they were working with was going off their medication, they would then be responsible to make sure the other mental health professionals that were serving that person had an awareness of that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more. Senator Bergen, when you speak of the team that they would be working with, who is that and what are the credentials of the rest of the team? This person is, if I read it right, a high school graduate that's had 30 some hours of training, I'm understanding 30 hours of training. Who are the other people on the team working with this peer review specialist?
Well, usually there would be some sort of a licensed clinical mental health professional as well as whoever is supervising that individual, as well as any psychiatric involvement that would be monitoring medications.
Senator Wergen, the one requirement is that they have to work under a clinical supervision of mental health professionals. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, if I can call your attention to the bottom of page 3 and the top of page 4, where it's existing language, you don't make any changes to it, but it it lists the areas in which the peer specialist would have to complete training, and it's 30 hours of training in 10 different areas, and some of those are some pretty big areas that actually would, what I think, you know, just if you decided to divide that equally, that would be 3 hours on each of these items. You know, you probably wouldn't have to do 3 items on recipient confidentiality, but I really think that you probably need more than 3 hours the broad subject of mental illness, the broad subject of psychotropic medications and their side effects, functional assessment. That's not a small thing to be saying. I'm just kind of wondering whether this section needs to be seriously updated with many more hours of training if you're going to go forward with this proposal. I don't know anything about this program, but I know that that's a lot to bite off with less than a week's worth of training.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the training requirements that you see are not divided equally. You were accurate in your assumption that the different items require a different amount of times, and it is also built upon the assumption that the training builds over years, and all of the work happens under the supervision of a mental health professional. So the individual coming in as a brand new peer support specialist would, in fact, have gone through some training before to become certified as a peer specialist before they join the treatment team. The 30 hours is ongoing training in areas that are important for all mental health workers and professionals to be cognizant of. So you're right, it's not equally divided, and there is no assumption that it's a one-time training. It is an ongoing training. Those are the minimum expectations.
Mr. Chair, it says you've successfully completed these within the past 2 years. So it doesn't talk about ongoing training. It doesn't say anything about a lot of those items. So what may be in practice isn't what's in law.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's required every year.
Senator Higgins, on page 2, line 10 through 12, it's requiring the ongoing.
Okay.
Mr. Connolly.
Mr. Chairman, Bill Connolly, representing the Consumer Survivor Network of Minnesota, which may not have been mentioned in Maureen Marin's testimony, is an organization that is made up with 100% of their board members, people who have recovered from mental illness and have had serious mental illnesses. Briefly, though, to address what Senator Higgins has brought up, on page 3 of the bill that you have, there is current law that was brought to the legislature in 2001, I believe, by the Department of Human Services when the state of Minnesota decided to Medicaid, if you will, the adult rehabilitative mental health services. So that was a new Medicaid MA service that was to be provided to people with mental illness. The talk about the tiered level of care, the treatment team, is likewise mentioned on page 3 in the current law of Medicaid for these services. And as you see on 314, it's required that the mental health professional meet the definitions, and that 245 there, that's the definition of the Adult Mental Health Act. That can be a psychiatrist, that can be an advanced practice nurse, that can be a PhD psychologist, that can be a licensed clinical social worker. We then also on 322 have the definition of mental health practitioner. Again, this is out of the Mental Health Act. And again on page 3, line 27, the current definition of a mental health worker that can work within that team. What this bill does, if you go back to page 1 of the bill, is to create a certified peer specialist program within the Department of Human Services to certify individuals who have had a mental health diagnosis and want to pursue a career track with the qualifications that are laid out on page 1 and 2 of the bill. So when you talk about the 30 hours of training, Senator Higgins, that refers to something that is not being proposed here. That's a minimum of the worker. And when Ms. Holton talks about continuing education, that's what's envisioned in the bill that's in front of you. When we talked to the Department of Human Services about constructing this language, we asked them if they wanted the long version, which would have run to about 6 pages of information if we were to pull the state of Georgia's peer specialist program up and to have offered it to the legislature as a matrix for creating this program. The Department of Human Services asked us to be more circumspect and have a smaller listing of the general guidelines. If the bill passes, the Department of Human Services is tasked with creating the program. They have said to us that they, if this passed, that they would be working certainly with the Consumer Survivor Network, but other groups of individuals representing consumers to define the exact specifics of how they would certify and then recertify these people.
Thank you.
Further questions, discussion from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, if there's no further discussion, then I would move that Senate File 515 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, if you don't mind. I share some of what Senator Partner Solon is saying with her concerns. But the one thing that comes through when I hear it, I think you said it, Ms. Holton, right? When someone else that has taken the medication or has had the problem says to someone, I like you better when you do that, it has an impact, unlike someone, myself, or as you said, yourself saying it. So I'm going to support this, but I have some hesitation. I wish I knew a little bit more.
Further discussion on the Berglund motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Much.
And before we take up Senate File 148, I wanted to announce a couple of members of the committee, three or four of us, are going on a tour tonight that you've all been invited to. If anybody is interested, it was going to be touring four different facilities for homelessness and so on. It meets at 6 o'clock in front of the Capitol. It's 3 hours. You have to eat before then. But if you're interested in going along, there is more room in the van. So if any members of the committee want to go, that's at 6 o'clock in front of the Capitol tonight. And with that, we'll move to Senate File 148. Oh, sorry, George, you want to come over here? Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 148 is a big mental health bill. It addresses many different issues. I think most of us are, most families have people with mental illness. Most of us are aware of it. I think in the last number of years, there have been some steps forward. Deinstitutionalization, unfortunately, by not providing good services, good treatment, good care for people with mental illness. We've put a lot of people out on the streets, and we put a lot of other people into the criminal justice system, harmed a lot of families. I think we have a lot of gaps in our mental health system. This legislation was put together by a number of mental health groups to try and address a whole range of concerns related to that. And actually, it was broken down into a number of bills because it touched on so many areas, and we were going to be addressing them as separate bills. And then the House decided last week that they wanted to take it up mainly as one bill. And so to go along with that, we are doing that. We have pulled several provisions out of the bill, and Senate Counsel did an excellent job of pulling together what is the A2 Delete Everything Amendment to make a lot of the changes that we were going to want to make that came out in some of the House committee hearings on it. And I'm going to offer that as an author's amendment in a minute, but also wanted to pull out a couple of other sections that we're going to be having traveling separately as well. One of them I would like, so I'm going to incorporate in my motion that we adopt the A2 amendment. Incorporated in that is deleting Article 3, Section 9, Section 13, bulk of which would be will be traveling in Senate File 861 of Senator Dibble. And I'm not sure how much they would be in this committee otherwise. But I would incorporate deleting those two sections from the A2 amendment and the appropriation language that goes with it. And also I would incorporate into it deleting Article 2, Section 5, which is Senator Torres Rey, I believe, has that in the bill, which is going to the Education Committee. That's the Teen Screen Program, which some of you have gotten some emails on. But that's a separate. This entire bill would have to go to Education Committee, if so. And so it's going to be traveling separate as a bill. I think it's Senate File 789. But I'm going to move, before we go through the bill, that we adopt as an author's amendment, the A2 amendment minus Articles 3, Section 9 and 13, and the appropriation language that goes with it. And same thing with Article 2, Section 5, the teen screen section and any appropriation language that would go with that. So I'll make that motion, and then I also had one more small amendment that I think Senator Erickson Ropes has in one section. But I'll make that motion. I see Senator Prettner so moves.
Okay. So Senator Marty moves Amendment A2.
Madam Chair.
Any discussions? Senator Prettner Solin.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, are we still going to hear those portions of this bill in this committee, though? The
Senator,
parts that will be deleted from this bill.
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Marty. I hope you do.
I guess I hadn't thought about whether they're also going to be in here, like the Columbia screen one, whether that would also go here as well as to education. I don't know if it is or not. I think it tends to be.
The council is saying that these bills may not be under the jurisdiction of this committee, and that's what they have been moved to the Education Committee.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Fishback.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, just to make sure that I got it, it's Article 2, Section 5, which is the Columbia Teen Screen Grants. That's on like page 6. And then on page 20, Article 3, Section 9 is the employment support. That's what it's titled. And then the last one on page 22, Article 3, Section 13, Incentive Payments Rulemaking Authority. Okay. Thank you. I just wanted
Senator
to
Marty,
make sure.
Is that correct? Thank you. Is there any further discussion on this amendment? If not, all of these in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries.
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Marty.
One final author's amendment, I believe Senator Erickson Ropes has to a section of the bill that she's been working on with MFIP Mental Health Pilot Project.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Marty. This would be on the A2 amendment. The Senate file is 148, and it would be page 16, line 24, delete 2-year and insert 3-year, and delete the word impact, insert the word effect. Okay, this is the A3 amendment. Thank you, Senator Worgen. Additionally, page 16, line 27, delete the word impact, insert the word effect. And on page 17, line 31, delete 2009 and insert 2011.
Senator Marty.
I would like that to be incorporated as part of the author's amendment. Again, I send the council and Senator Erickson Ropes, that was part of what was intended, so I would like to move that. I mean, if the committee wants to debate it, we can, but I was going to suggest we do it as an author's amendment.
Okay. Is there any discussion of the amendment to the... Excuse me. I just need to consult for a moment.
Senator Marty, actually, there's one more section, Article 3, Section 7, it's the Mental Health Fatality Review Team, and it relates to the Hennepin County Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee, and it's my understanding that that is under the jurisdiction of Judiciary. And I think that's traveling separately also, so you may want to delete that section too.
And Madam Chair, Senate Counsel Ms. Abdelhoven says that that's in Senate File 1067. I'm not sure whose bill that is, but if so, well, first let's adopt the A3 amendment.
Okay. Is there any discussion about the A3 amendment? Senator Prentice-Allen?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I'm not sure I'm following very closely, but what Ms. White just added, is that a part of this A3 amendment, or is that
no.
separate?
Okay. That's okay. We're just moving on the amendment from Senator Erickson-Robes right now. So that's the one you just got, this one. Any further discussion on this motion? If not, all of those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries.
Madam Chair, Senator Council, you're saying just Section 7 of Article 3 would be the one entire Section 7?
Yes, in addition to the other sections that you had deleted.
That's about pages 18 through 17 through 20. So I'll move that we strike Article 3, Section 7 as well. So it'll be traveling along as well.
Is there any discussion on the author's amendment? If not, all of those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I'd like to have Sue Abdelhoven from NAMI present the, go through the bill section by section, and then we can take questions or witnesses, whichever makes sense to do next.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sue Abdelhoven, and I'm the Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and co-chair of the Mental Health Legislative Network. I'll try to go quickly, even though it's a long bill. So Article 1 is the criminal justice section, and that's not under the jurisdiction of this committee, so I think I'll just move on to Article 2, if that's okay. Article 2 on Section 1 deals with the Children's Mental Health Collaboratives, making sure that they have money to continue their work and including young adults who meet the criteria for transition services. Section 2 requires foster parents prior to the placement of a child in their home to complete 2 hours of their existing training that addresses the causes, symptoms, and key warning signs of mental health disorders, cultural considerations, and approaches for dealing with the child's behavior. And then at least 1 hour of their annual 12-hour training must be on children's mental health issues. And this is also contained in Senate File 862, authored by Senator Erickson-Robes. The next section provides funding for one or more projects that provide early intervention collaborative services to children who are at risk for child maltreatment, substance abuse, and violent offending. This is modeled on the ACE program in Ramsey County and is also contained in Senate File 492, Senator Mua. Section 4 increases the payment rates by 33.7% for certain services provided by CTSS providers, which are Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, and for the diagnostic assessments of children and adolescents. Section 6 convenes a work group to study the unmet need for children's mental health wraparound services. Wraparound services cannot be funded per se under Medicaid, but their components are, and this work group would look at the components of wraparound and see if there's anything that we are not currently covering under that. Section 7 provides grants to organizations that provide trauma-focused, evidence-based services to children who have been exposed to violence or who are refugees. This is also contained in Senate File 863, as is the next section, which would create set-aside funding for respite care to counties for families who have a child with a serious emotional disturbance. Some of the funding can also be used to recruit, train, and support respite care providers, since right now we don't have many of them. Moving on to Article 3, Section 1, which is contained in Senate File 858 by Senator Torres-Ray, establishes a loan forgiveness program for individuals who are employed by a culturally specific organization. This is a way to try to get more mental health professionals who are of the various cultures that live in Minnesota to actually become professionals and meet the needs of their communities. The next section modifies the Community Support Services Program. Many of them have felt a loss in dollars recently and want to make sure that people understand the services that they provide, many of which cannot be billed for under medical assistance, and make sure they have funding to continue their important work. Section 3 just clarifies we have agreements with bordering states in terms of 72-hour holds and other things under the commitment law. And this is just clarifying that if a professional is licensed in another state, that that licensing requirement works. So it's just, you know, someone would have met the requirement if they were under Minnesota licensing, but they live in North Dakota and practice there, and so we're just recognizing them. And that's also included under Senate File 860 by Senator Erickson Ropes. Section 4 makes grants to nonprofit organizations to ensure that culturally competent mental health services are provided. We view this as kind of a bridging service between the culturally specific organizations and mental health professionals. Section 5 expands eligibility for general assistance medical care to people who have been diagnosed with a mental illness in a corrections institution for a period of 3 months after being released from confinement. Many of them, when they leave, do not have health insurance coverage to pay for their medications. Section 6, which is also under Senate File 613 by Senator Erickson Ropes, establishes a 2-year pilot project to measure the impact of a child's identified mental health needs on the Minnesota Family Investment Program participants' ability to obtain and retain employment. Section 8 authorizes the Commissioner of Human Services to make any budget-neutral changes to medical assistance coverage to implement evidence-based practices. Section 10 requires the Office of Enterprise Technology in consultation with the Commissioner of Human Services to provide televideo conferencing to certain mental health providers at no cost to the provider, and this is contained in Senate File 903 by Senator Marty. Section 11 funds up to 3 programs that serve high-risk adults with a dual diagnosis of serious mental illness and co-occurring substance abuse problems. Section 12 it has the Commissioner of Human Services to explore in consultation with the Office of Higher Education options to look at ensuring students who are in college to make sure that that, in a sense, high-risk group has coverage. Moving on then to Article 4, which contains a lot of kind of more technical funding issues. Section 1 includes both ARMS, Adult Rehab Mental Health Services, and Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, including them as part of the inflationary payment rate adjustments. Section 2 requires a diagnostic assessment for ARMS to be reimbursed at the same rate as the public nurse assessment rate for personal care services. Section 3 modifies payment rates for social workers and others providing mental health services so that when they've finished all their work and are only doing supervisor work, that they get paid for that. Section 4 increases the rate for travel time for people who are, you know, in the rural parts of the state and have to travel to provide mental health services. Section 5 includes telemedicine reimbursement for the originating fees and the cost of broadband connections. Section 6 provides that, again, for diagnostic assessments, this time provided under Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, be paid at the same rate as the public health nurse assessment. Section 7 excludes mental health services that are covered under a managed care plan from rateable reductions. Section 9 relates to the critical access mental health rate increase, including them in the 23.7% rate increase from last year. Section 10 amends the general assistance medical care services by making the coverage for mental health services under this program the same as under medical assistance. So this is kind of the uniform benefit set across all of the public health programs. Section 11 modifies the Minnesota Supplemental Aid Program, providing an increase for adults eligible for the CADI waiver who are shelter needy. Section 12 strikes a limited care benefit set for mental health services. Section 13 excludes mental health services from the Minnesota copayment fee of $3 for a non-preventative visit. Section 14 includes all of the medical assistance services under Minnesota Care for mental health care. Section 15 strikes that an applicant has to have no insurance for 4 months in order to be eligible for Minnesota Care, and adds to the list of services for children when they don't have, you know, kind of good coverage, adds poor mental health coverage as another reason why a child could obtain Minnesota Care. Section 16, again, excludes mental health services from the ratable reduction payments to managed care plans for people under Minnesota Care. Section 17 increases the reimbursement rate for CTSS providers and ARMS providers. Section 18, provided there's federal approval, expands medical assistance coverage to include family psychoeducation, intensive outpatient treatment, collateral services, contacts, coordination, and care management. And that's a brief summary of the bill. I felt like I was on the awards program last night when they had to explain the whole thing in a minute. But
you did great. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, a couple of comments on that. One is, as you see, a lot of this is funding issues, and that's going to be difficult, but it shows what the problem is. I mean, a whole lot of these issues we could make a real difference in. It's Article 3, Section 5, I think it was, on the GAMC, the people who are leaving prison. I mean, you think how foolish the system is right now when somebody gets out prison. Often they were there because of a mental health problem, and they need their medication. They get out on the street, and they have nothing. So filling in the gap and making sure for at least the first 3 months means they'll hit the street with ability to have the prescriptions that they need. A number of other things I think were worth pointing out, that if we address health care in a bigger sense, we will solve these problems. I think Article 4, Section 15, part of that is in Senator Berglund's bill, Senate File 2. If we take care of, if we make sure health care is available to all, we'll be addressing a whole lot of this. Same thing like Article 3, Section 12, where we're doing a study of college students' access to health care. Again, those are the years when a whole lot of serious persistent mental illness shows up in people in the late teens, early 20s, and it's a very vulnerable population, and we want to make sure that they're covered. So there's a lot of overlap in not just with other mental health bills, but a whole lot of our health care in general would be addressed by this. But
that's different.
We can start with testimony, or you can have questions first if you have any you want to start with.
Senator Prudnicell.
Madam Chair, either Senator Marty or Ms. Abderholden, if you could address section Article 4, Section 18. In it, I'm not. And I'm wondering what different services are being asked to be included under a waiver for mental health services here.
Madam Chair, Senator Partner Solon, the first is family psychoeducation, which is an evidence-based practice and which is currently not covered. And that really is where a provider would provide a lot more information to families about the illness and treatment options and things like that. The second one is intensive mental health outpatient treatment, which we're talking more intensive, at least 2 hours per day, at least 9 to 20 hours per week. And that could include things like group psychotherapy or psychoeducational, medical monitoring, behavioral parent training, service coordination and referral, those kinds of things. Coordination and care management would also be added. Collateral contacts, especially when a CTSS provider needs to talk to a teacher or something like that. And a lot of this was a part of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Providers, their legislative package, and Ron Brand is on testifying later and might be able to more clearly answer your question than me.
Okay, and Madam Chair?
Yes,
the intensive mental health outpatient treatment being identified separate from a partial hospitalization program?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Senator Marty?
Start with the witnesses then.
Oh, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yes, Senator Fishback.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, on I guess it's page 2, it's subdivision 3A. It talks about the intake procedure, and it requires corrections officers, or I guess an approved health screening tool to identify someone who may have mental illness. And I don't see an appropriation line for that, so that's just something that the counties or the local groups are going to have to pick up.
Madam Chair, Senator, it's actually, right now there's a free tool called the GAIN screening instrument. We have met with the county Association of Minnesota County staff, including the corrections people, and they're actually fine with this. They think it's important to start using an effective tool. It's very short. It would just be added on to the booking questions, and at this point they don't, at least as of Thursday afternoon, had no opposition to it.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Fishback.
What do they do once they're done? I mean, if are there any requirements as to what they, how they act once they've figured out that someone may have a mental illness?
Madam Chair, Senator Fishback, it really is up to the local jail. In some situations, they may decide that maybe they need to be concerned about this person being a suicide risk inside the jail, and they may decide to watch that person more closely. Part of it depends on how long the individual is there. Many of the county staff said, you know, we don't really necessarily have resources to do something with this, but we feel that we don't have good data. And so once we get more data, we might be able to do more in terms of referring people for assessments, especially people who are there for a longer time, looking even at discharge planning as a part of that.
And Madam Chair, are we taking questions on the whole bill? I mean, is this the time we should be doing that?
Senator Marty, are we?
Madam Chair, Senator Fishbach, you can now. Otherwise, some of your issues may be answered by the testimony. If you want something now, go ahead. And like again, Article 1 we didn't go through because it's going to be, this bill is headed next to Judiciary. But again, you're welcome to ask questions about it or...
And Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I got off Judiciary as quickly as I could, so I thought that I would ask the question here. Madam Chair, Senator Marty, in the section about the higher education, the program to study the health insurance, I guess, are we seeing a trend that needs to be looked at? Because I was always under the impression that they required it, and you had to present a, if you declined the school-offered health insurance, that you had to present, you know, something on another insurance card that you were still covered under your parents or you carried it through some other way. And so I guess I thought that was being taken care of. And are we seeing a trend towards students not having that?
Madam Chair, I believe some schools do require it. Others do not. I think the fact that you're seeing some schools beginning to require it, you're seeing it in legislation, you're seeing it everywhere, is because it is such a big problem. The reason it's in this bill is because, again, that's an age when a lot of mental illness begins to show up in a person. I have a foster brother who had showed up when he was in college. Time when kids tend not to have health insurance these days, and so this is just one more attempt to take a look at how we can make sure that there is coverage there.
Okay. Well, and you know what, Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I'll wait, and if they're not answered, I'll go back to them. Yeah.
Senator Fishback. So let's proceed with the testimony. We have about 10 people who wish to testify, so done. Go ahead.
Okay, call Senator Deborah Marty. Selv.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to say that a few weeks ago you received this blue booklet, which was put together by the Mental Health Legislative Network, which contains background information on all of the legislation that you see before you today. And just a reminder that 1 in 5 adults are affected by mental illness and 1 in 10 children. And despite research that demonstrates that treatment works, despite the fact that recovery and resiliency is possible, too many children and adults do not have access to the treatment and supports that enable them to live successful lives. And what this bill really attempts to do is to support early intervention, make available health care and treatment, strengthen the infrastructure of our mental health system, ensure access to providers, and provide those services that support children and adults in the community. I just want to mention one email that I got recently from Leanne from actually, I believe, Senator Coring's district, who said, "The treatment I have received, in spite of the struggles with insurance, has helped me tremendously. A few years ago, I was not even able to work. Now I work full-time as an executive assistant to 4 real estate brokers, and I love my job. I love my life. I narrowly escaped from losing it. I am grateful for that and want to help others get quality treatment so that they too can live happy and productive lives. And I urge you today to join with Leanne. You have the power to help others and to really create a better mental health system. And I did want to mention you also have a packet that we put together that has fact sheets on a number of the programs that are being presented today as well. And I'll leave my time for the other people.
Thank you.
Thank you. If Ms. Salve is not here, Ms. Cheryl Smetana McHugh.
Good afternoon and welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to be with you today. I am Cheryl Smetana McHugh. I am a social worker and director of programs at Therapeutic Services Agency, which provides in-home family-based services in 9 counties in east central Minnesota and in the metro counties. I'm also here on behalf of my fine CTSS colleagues who work throughout Minnesota. In your packet, you will find a map of Minnesota and a list of the CTSS providers by county. I am here to ask for your support for Senate File 148, and in particular, the proposed rate increase for services delivered under Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, also known as CTSS. This bill is Article 2, Section 4 in Senate File 148. This language is also included in Senate File 946, Senator Lori's bill. You have materials in your packet that provides information on CTSS. What I hope to convey to you today is how important these services are and how necessary this rate adjustment is to their continuing effectiveness and, to be quite honest, their survival. CTSS was implemented in 2004 and combined 3 separate children's mental health services that were family community support services, therapeutic supportive foster care, and in-home family-based services into one service category to maximize use of Medicaid dollars for services for children and youth with emotional disturbance. Historically, these services were provided under contract with counties and funded by county dollars through a combination of state grant funds and property tax dollars. Providers negotiated rates for services with the counties they served, delivered those services as requested, and billed the relevant county. Under this system, providers were often expected to provide, and they delivered, whatever services were necessary to help the child and family. Day treatment providers, also a part of CTSS, were historically financially supported through partnerships with schools and counties to provide services for youth who needed the kind of wraparound services that day treatment can provide to youth with mental health and behavioral problems who are struggling to function in a school setting. The program was supported financially to be available, flexible, and responsive to youth in need as identified by the school, parents, or county. As counties and schools experienced greater budget challenges, they gradually withdrew their financial support, and providers were left to try and provide these services exclusively with funding from Medicaid dollars. Many of the services counties, schools, and families need and expect are not covered by medical assistance. One of the most important aspects of working with children and a requirement for CTSS providers that is not covered is coordination of services. In your packet, you have a yellow handout that portrays the many services, systems, and individuals that can be involved in one family and child's life. We receive many referrals for children under the age of 8. Their presenting issues include anxiety problems, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, attention deficit disorder, adjustment disorders, attachment disorders, etc. Especially worth noting is that most of these children have families who are also experiencing significant challenges. The parents have mental health problems or chemical health problems or both. The family may live in poverty. The home sees domestic violence. There may be poor parenting skills. The family lacks social supports and connection. Often these families are working with child protection services in their counties. Many of the children and youth we work with have been abused or neglected or both. We also receive referrals for older children and teenagers. These children and youth, too, have the plethora of mental health diagnoses I have already mentioned, and often significant impairment of functioning in their family lives, school experience, community behavior, employment readiness, and friendship experiences, or lack of them. Many of the children and youth we provide services to are living with their families. Others are children and youth who are living with foster families or are in relative placement, pre-adoptive placements, or living with adoptive parents. In providing services to children and youth utilizing CTSS, we are required to provide services to the child that is specific to their need, diagnosis, impairment of functioning, based on medical necessity, and utilizing evidence-based practices. And as I mentioned earlier, we are also required to coordinate those treatment efforts with other providers and persons involved in matters concerning the child's mental health. I would like to provide a typical case example. A referral is received to provide services to a 12-year-old girl and her brother. Their history includes abandonment by their mother, who left them alone when she left with a man to go to another state. After 3 weeks of being home alone at ages 9 and 11, they came to the attention of the local county Child Protection Services Department. They were placed in foster care and lived there until this girl's behavior became more than this family could manage. They were then placed in another foster home. The girl presents with significant depression, frequent stealing problems from family members in the home and in stores, conflict with her foster family and brother, is failing in school, and is obese. She pines for her mother, who is not available to her. The county is involved in termination of parental rights proceedings in court and will ultimately seek to have this girl and her brother adopted. She also engages in self-injurious behaviors, which includes cutting on her arms and legs, and which require periodic medical attention and are very distressing to her foster parents. It is at this point that we begin CTSS treatment services and work to address the many problems she is struggling with. As you might guess, the coordination is such an important part of our work to address her needs. We coordinate with the multiple service providers, the family skills trainer who works with this girl and her brother, and also with her and her foster family, the individual psychotherapist, the psychiatrist who is prescribing medication to begin treating the depression, the school who is assessing her and determining how to help her with school success, the medical professionals who treat her injuries as they occur and assist with health and diet issues. We work with the diversion probation officer who got involved when she last stole from the local store, the county social worker and the guardian ad litem who are involved with the court proceedings and recognize how this process impacts her mental health. We work with the foster parents who care deeply about this girl and live with the daily challenges they face as she pushes them away emotionally and then begs for attention and needs so much. Only direct services to the child or family and none of these collaborative and coordination efforts are covered services under CTSS. I would love to tell you the details of this girl's story, and I will tell you, and that today, after 16 months of treatment, this girl now is much less depressed. She has experienced being an A student and has developed significant skills in being a poet and public speaker. She has known success in meaningful connection with her foster parents, has been active in church youth group, and went on a missions trip to help orphaned children. She was elected to her student council. She has not had an incident of stealing in a long time. She has lost weight and looks healthy. She and her brother get along better and enjoy a healthier relationship. She has friends in the community, and she is fun to be with. She has grown in her management of the grief she knows at the loss of her mother. She is currently living successfully with her pre-adoptive family. This is just one example, and I could tell you of so many other children and youth who have been helped by these services. This is very important work that we do with Minnesota children who are needy and deserve meaningful professional services such as CTSS. As service providers, we need your support to do this work. Good senators, I present myself to you today to request your support of Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports receiving a 33.7% rate increase, not because it would be nice, not because it would be good, not because it would be right, but because it is good and right and necessary. As CTSS providers, we are hanging on by a thread. Our organizations have used up any reserve we may have had. We have made cuts and changes in how we manage staff and expenses. We have tapped out our sister programs for subsidy to survive as CTSS providers. We have high costs to provide this service and incoming low revenue. We desperately need this rate increase to continue to be your worker bees, your mental health practitioners and professionals in providing this necessary service to children and youth with significant mental health needs in Minnesota. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Senator Perna-Sullivan?
Yeah, Madam Chair, sorry, I missed your name.
It's a mouthful. My name is Cheryl Smetna-McHugh.
Still don't get it.
I'm Cheryl. You can call me Cheryl.
I'm reading your handout. Yes. And could you tell me the significance of the cities following the counties? They are not cities that are in those counties.
It's the city that has the service that's providing it to that county.
Okay.
These are county services. They are provided at the county
like
level.
It says, like, Grand Rapids is serving Beltrami County, so I assume it's a Grand Rapids program that reaches.
Well,
that's correct. Organizations may provide services in multiple counties and be located in one primary site as their primary headquarters or central site for business operations.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Perna-Sullivan.
I certainly do support your request for additional funds. I think it's necessary. But I'm also concerned that, again, we're creating a multi-tiered system where some providers get paid one rate and other providers get another rate. And now we've got another set of providers that are getting a third rate. And actually what has been left out of here is where there are some traditional services that are provided in a community that were left out of last year's increases, and they're being left out of this year's increases. I would much prefer to see something that was across the board where all the providers got paid adequately. But I do support your request.
Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate that very much. I will highlight with our in-home service delivery model, this has been a particularly strain with needing to put gas in cars to go places. I would concur with you that the entire mental health field needs to be paid properly in order to satisfy the needs and to earn professionals staying in our field to really do meaningful work. Thank you.
I have a question,
Ms.
Smetna-McHugh. I am quite concerned about the number of providers, and I think that's why you want to coordinate. But my question relates to, you have a provider, you provided this, which is good. You have a provider mental health practitioner. You have a provider mental health professional. You have a county mental health worker. You have a psychiatrist. Is this another person that is supposed to coordinate all of this? So altogether, a family may have to deal with 7, 8, 9, 10 providers of different services, because these are just social services providers. And the coordination of services that you are requesting will add another provider that has to be coordinated. I was an ombudsperson, and I was supposed to meet with everyone to talk about a hearing with a child a few years ago. And so I had to call all of these professionals. So would a person have to call a coordinator now?
All right.
Is that an additional position?
No, I would like to be real clear at this point. The CTSS provider is the party that is responsible for the coordination of services specific to the child's mental health and mental health services. And so that function is already occurring by the CTSS provider. It is not an additional person or an additional role.
Okay.
We're just asking, please help us cover that as far as being paid for as a service we are obligated, responsible to be providing already. And I will highlight, in my example that I did share, is a complex case scenario. I wish I could say most of them are not. However, the case I did provide you is a pretty typical one, and if you had the role you indicated, you understand the complexity of many of these cases. But not every single child has every single one of these persons that I've indicated on the ECHO map. But the CTSS provider is already doing that coordination, and we're being underpaid to provide that.
Thank you. Do we move to our next?
Madam Chair, I'll call Angie Stradic.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If you could please introduce yourself.
My name is Angie Stradig, and I am Family Support Manager at the American Indian Family Center and a mental health therapist.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Angie Stradig, like I just said. I'm an enrolled member of the Lake Manitoba Band of Ojibwe and a mental health professional at the American Indian Family Center. The American Indian Family Center provides culturally specific mental health services along with other health-related services. I'm also a member of a committee of culturally specific providers who are working hard to meet the mental health needs of people in our communities. In mental health care, like regular health care, disparity is a huge concern in Minnesota and across the nation. The rate of attempted suicide is greater among Latino youth than white, 10.7%, yet less than 1 in 11 contact mental health care facilities, and less than 1 in 5 contact general health care providers for treatment. In the Asian American community, there's a great deal of shame or embarrassment related to mental health illness. One study found that only 17% of those experiencing symptoms seek care. In the African American community, the percentage of African Americans receiving treatment from any source was only about half that of whites. Most African Americans who receive care relied on the safety net of public sector programs. Language, stigma, lack of insurance are key barriers in all communities of color, but even more so is the lack of culturally specific providers. These providers are important in that they have trusting relationships in the community and understand the cultural implications of how mental illness is viewed and treated. For example, in the American Indian community, the impact of mental illness is devastating. Social policies of the past, such as out-of-culture adoptions, the brutal boarding schools, relocations to reservations, to name a few, attempted to destroy our cultural ways by means of assimilating our community into dominant culture. These policies of the past continue to affect our community today. Only a generation or two later, our community experiences significantly higher rates of poverty, out-of-home placements, violence, and substance abuse. Suicide is 190% higher in our Native communities than for whites. Health disparities such as diabetes, alcohol abuse, heart disease, and infant mortality are much higher in our community, and our life expectancy much lower. Our youth have higher rates of mental illness, including substance abuse, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and suicidal thoughts. All of this contributes to a life where you hear of tragic occurrences way too frequently and in most families. Even still, the American Indian community still survives, is resilient and strong because of our traditional cultural ways. For example, a recent study by Arlene Stiffman from Washington University recognized the importance of traditional healers within the American Indian communities and their use of prayers, Native medicines, and ceremonies in relationship to mental health services. The study found that traditional healers offered services to youth that were very similar to those of professional providers, including referrals, counseling, and family resources, as well as their unique traditional healing. They also found that the youth who reported higher levels of cultural and spiritual involvement in American Indian culture were more likely to use the traditional providers. Traditional healers reported that they formed collaborative relationships with other providers and were firmly embedded in the larger mental health service systems in their community and referral network with health and education, inpatient mental health services, outpatient, and other non-traditional American Indian services. Results revealed that traditional healers offered traditional medicine to almost all the youth they served, but traditional healers also offered youth many of the same services offered by professional providers, such as counseling, referral, and family resources. And there are two sections of the bill that is before you today that are important to help address the disparities in our communities. The first is the Loan Forgiveness Program. In order to receive medical assistance dollars, our programs need to have licensed mental health professionals. It can be very difficult to find someone of our culture who has these credentials, and even if we do, it's only a matter of time before we lose them to the county or state or schools who can offer them more money and benefits. The second part of the bill is grant funds that will enable our culturally specific organizations to quote-unquote bridge the gap between traditional mental health providers in our communities and to provide culturally specific support services. On behalf of our children who need access to services to be successful in school, home, and the community, I urge you to support these sections of the bill. Too often our children are placed in foster care, end up in the juvenile justice system, or worse, because we have not been able to address their mental health needs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you.
This afternoon.
Are there any questions for Ms. Stratic? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Call Andrea Ayers.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Ayers, and I'm with Family and Children's Service. We're a metro-based social service agency, and we're also a member of the Mental Health Legislative Network. While we support the entire bill, I'm here to speak to just one part, and if I have the correct version, I think it's on page 16. It's Article 3, Section 6. It's the Minnesota Family Investment Program Children's Mental Health Pilot Project. You know, there was an amendment earlier today to make it a 3-year pilot project. We did that at the bequest of the department. They thought they might need 3 years to actually get enough data to do a great analysis, so we added a year to it. But anyways, what this would do, it would appropriate funds to employment service providers that are interested in looking more closely at the children who are on the MFIP program. As many of you know, it's our state welfare to work program, and while we have about 24,000 cases, we have about 46,000 children on the program, so it is a kids program. While we do a fairly adequate job right now of looking at the adults on the program to assess mental health needs, chemical health needs, domestic violence needs, there is virtually nothing done to look at the children. The focus of the program is primarily to get these folks to work, but oftentimes if your children is struggling in school and you're getting called out of work and you're getting called out of training, you end up not being able to succeed in the program because your children's needs come first. This is an opportunity for employment service providers to look more closely at the families on a very voluntary basis, to ask the families, is there something going on with your child that we need to address so you can be more successful in the program, so you can keep your job, so you can get a job, so your child can stay in school when they're supposed to be in school. I can stand for any other questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Ayers? Thank you for your testimony.
Call Ron Brand.
Very succinct.
Welcome, Mr. Brand. Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Brand, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. It's a fairly large, probably the largest organization of mental health providers in the state. We have sites in around 120 different locations, and our members provide an array of mental health services. They're typically larger nonprofit organizations that provide psychiatry and CTSS services and traditional outpatient services, ARM services, and things like that. Their key safety net providers have a large number of uninsured and underinsured people who have exhausted their benefits. People who are low income and are insured but have very high cost sharing, and things like that. We have an awkward, difficult situation. You've heard much of this, and I'm going to be very brief. But we have many, many people, individuals, adults and children and their families, who need services, they want services, And it's just odd, if you have that much demand, you would think you would be able to hire more staff and be able to try to meet those needs. But we lose money on every service that we provide. You can't hire more staff. The revenues simply do not cover the cost of delivering the services that are expected. We have long wait lists. We have wait times before appointments. We have organizations that have merged or consolidated or have gone out of business or that have laid off staff at the same time, and we have increasing demand. We either need to cover and pay for services that are expected and are expected in rules or as part of best practices and pay for those activities like the family consultation or the family psychoeducation or some of the care coordination and build those things into the services that we're doing and pay for those, or we need to increase the rates for the things that are now covered. If this bill passed, we could do some amazing things for individuals and their families. Better diagnostic assessment is really a cornerstone, starting with that. We have provisions in here that would enable us to do services through telemedicine or telehealth, which allows us to get services to remote areas. Family psychoeducation would help families, parents, learn about the illness and how they could be a better caregiver. Being able to provide coaching or coordination with physicians, with schools, with social workers. Being able to hire more staff would reduce wait time and allow us to get to services to people earlier, before their lives have started spinning out of control, or if they were in a crisis, be able to get them the right service in a timely way. This provides for intensive coordinated outpatient services for kids and adults. And the idea there is really to kind of embed some of the service coordination and some of the kind of the spaces that between some of the parts of the services to try to do that in a coordinated way and to cover those activities that enable us to coordinate and communicate and provide a coherent service plan. And I think it's also important to note that I think this bill would allow us to innovate. Currently, things are so tight and organizations are operating on such a small margin. Our members' profit margin last year, they're all nonprofits, but their profit margin was 0.2%. That's 0.2% on average across the state. And they spent down, you know, it's just the amazing the financial pressures, and how do you innovate in a situation like that is very difficult. So we are delighted to join with others to support this bill and encourage you to pass it on.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Brandt? Senator Brunasol.
Madam Chair, Mr. Brandt, just a comment that there are a number of mental health departments within larger organizations that are losers. And the other, like hospitals and clinics, are helping to support them because their reimbursement is so low.
That's correct. It's a problem that's pervasive in our system for a variety of reasons.
Are there any other questions? I think we need to move to the next. Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Ms. Gewirtz.
Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee. My name is Abigail Gewirtz. I am the project director for the Minnesota Child Response Center and an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota. I'm here to speak to Article 2, Section 7 of this bill, Trauma-Focused Evidence-Based Practices to Children. Janice is a 5-year-old girl whom one of my colleagues worked with. Her mother escaped continuous domestic assaults over a number of years, which Janice witnessed. Together, they escaped and entered a battered women's shelter. Janice's mother had been worn down by the abuse, and it was all she could do to finally escape. Janice had nightmares wet her bed and had screaming matches with her mother when she didn't want to do something. Children who are traumatized by exposure to violence often carry the burden of the trauma with them and go unidentified, or worse, misidentified as behavior problems or nervous. Studies have indicated that far more homeless than housed children have experienced multiple traumatic events, Those include witnessing violence in the home or in the community, separation from their primary caregiver, exposure to catastrophic accidents or acts of nature like tornadoes, or victims of abuse. While some children, due to protective factors, show resilience, others need help to recover and stay healthy. Studies have consistently shown that the mental health needs of homeless or formerly homeless children, who are much more likely than never homeless children of similar socioeconomic status, to suffer from traumatic stress symptoms, anxiety, depression, and other problems. We conducted a local study in 18 supportive housing agencies with 450 children and found that 15% of 0 to 4-year-olds, 47% of 5 to 11-year-olds, and 67% of teens manifested emotional, behavioral, or learning problems. As family homelessness increases, more kids are exposed to traumatic events every day. Over the past couple of decades, we've made remarkable advances in our understanding of childhood traumatic stress, thanks in large part to the work of a national network that focuses on meeting the psychosocial needs of traumatized children, the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. Both prevention and treatment services are available for kids who are exposed to many different kinds of traumatic events. Our biggest challenge now is to get those services that work, best practices, into the hands of those who daily serve homeless children in order to help increase access to quality care for traumatized homeless kids. To do this, we have to enhance awareness of the needs of traumatized children, facilitate partnerships between community mental health providers and frontline providers like shelters and supportive housing agencies. Stressed homeless families would then be able to access best practice prevention and treatment services within shelters and their housing agencies. Grant funding would provide an opportunity for the development of relationships between agencies to improve outcomes for children and their families. And it would provide for the development of an infrastructure to increase the interconnectedness between those providing best practices for traumatized children. Ultimately, children are the ones who would benefit from this. I'm really pleased to join with others to support this bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the witness? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We have two more people who wish to testify. Senator Marty, would you want me to call them?
Mr.
Michael? Go ahead. Mr. Michael Unlin, is he here? Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman and committee members. My name is Michael Undlin. I need to start by saying that I'm a little bit off topic today. Shortly before noon, I got the green light to speak on some issues associated with the interface between mental illness and law enforcement. And then a few minutes before the committee began, I was informed that there's been a change in terms of where the focus of this committee is versus other committees. I ask that you indulge me briefly, if for no other reason than to sensitize this group to things that can happen in that interface so that as ongoing discussions occur, and if I'm so fortunate as to try to influence language in another committee, you're not caught off guard and you have some sense of where it may have come from. Can you indulge me for a few minutes or should I wait for another time?
Yes, absolutely. If you can be brief, that would be great.
There is a handout so that you can have more detail for those who want it. My mental illness began about 4.5 years ago, a little less than that. Prior to that, I would have been considered fairly stable, normal father of two great daughters and a wife of 29 years. But things happened and it hit me. I've never had trouble with the law or anything like that. I've been a law-abiding citizen. I've got a master's in business administration. Everything kind of went to heck in a handbasket in 2002. On June 6th, I went into the hospital, decompensated, suicidal text messages to my wife while I was drunk. And she called the police, who picked me up at a movie theater and brought me into the hospital. That police force, Plymouth, treated me very well. They had to take me down. They had to take me down hard. it's okay. They did the right thing for my safety and others. So this is not a an indictment against all of law enforcement, just those that have gone wrong. On June 9th, I was to be discharged from the hospital. There was some concerns about the nature of my discharge and work that the hospital hadn't completed. Instead of working that out, when I asked to talk to supervisors, they called security to wheel me out to the curb. Had I gotten out of the chair instead of remaining non-responsive, non-talkative as I had been for a fair amount of time, they would have left me on the curb or the street. They decided better than that to bring me into the ER. The ER, instead of readmitting me or doing a psych eval, had me taken out by the police. Non-responsive, in an ER, on a gurney, fetal position, not talking. The police officer, who theoretically has training in trying to recognize when there might be a mental health issue, in order to force me to try to talk, or in order to force me to talk, jammed his knuckle in my ear. It's very painful. He did that a couple times. I didn't respond. He arrested me for trespassing. That has been, by the way, dismissed. I wasn't trespassing. Instead of wheeling me out like someone else with a disability, a physical disability might have had, he drugged me out, feet behind. It was a long ways. They carried me into the intake at the jail. They went through a jail questionnaire like has been referenced today in terms of a tool to assess mental health. I remember some of those questions being asked. I was still non-responsive, not responding to anything because of the state of my mind. My non-responsiveness was not coded as a concern. It was coded as, gee, I didn't say yes to the question, are you on meds? So they didn't treat me any differently, even though all the procedures suggest that they would. We needed stronger language forcing people to do the job that their policies and procedures say to do in law. That was at 2:45 in the afternoon. By 11:15, I had spent 4 hours in five-point restraint. It's called a restraint chair. I had never heard of it. They intentionally put the handcuffs on me before they put me in the restraint chair such that they were brutally painful. During the first hour, I could tolerate it. I don't consider that to have been torture. The next three-plus hours was torture. My wife gets concerned when I use that language because people will reel back because they don't want to believe that. It wasn't torture like POW camps. To anybody that's been there, you know, I don't claim that. But I do claim that what happened happened. I spent three-plus hours crying, begging, pleading for help. They didn't bring the nurse. Their health and wellness checks lasted many times fractions of seconds. The jail personnel, you can hear them on the footage which has been provided in the CD-ROM, is jail footage. You can hear them laughing and mocking in the background throughout the course of those hours. They don't care. The fact that I just see this morning that this issue has been moved to a judiciary committee as opposed to a mental or a health committee is nothing short of frightening. They don't care. I was there. And you can see it. And it's not just about me. One person mentally ill, the officer was kind enough to suggest that if you really wanted to kill himself, you don't just jump in front of a car and miss. You make sure that you do it. Other people were called idiots, boneheads. It runs throughout. When I came out of the chair, a guard happened to touch one of my wrists to help me up. He didn't do it intentionally, but you can hear the scream when he touched my wrist. It sounded like an animal dying when he hit me with that. I pulled my wrist away. It made him angry. I asked for the police. I asked for pictures, photographs, an attorney as they brought me out of what I was telling them had been torture. It was entirely ignored, even though there is tons of policy and procedure theoretically designed to protect me against that. They didn't do it. The laws need to be stronger. So I appreciate your indulgence very much. I'm gonna close it right there on the back of the sheet. There are a few areas that I highlight in terms of some language. One other key one is there was language about the Commissioner of Health providing consulting input to the Commissioner of Public Safety or Corrections to give corrections the power, the veto power, which he has if it's simply consulting versus a joint decision, gives corrections too much power. Anyway, thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Undlin. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair, I'd just like to comment.
Senator Murray.
The point of sending it to the crime to the Judiciary Committee is they're the ones who are supposed to be looking at what's wrong with the way law enforcement does. And I think our plan is, again, the provisions in the bill and your suggestions we'll take a look at there. The plan is to help address this. I think your point is well taken that it is a mental health issue. We want to make sure our law enforcement, our crime, the system we deal with people handles it well wherever it is. So appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Undlin.
Thank you.
We have one more person. We have about 5 minutes to finish. Dr. Karen Efron. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Dr. Karen Efron, I'm a pediatrician, a mother of three, and a policy analyst for four national organizations that are concerned about mental health screening, which is what I will talk about today. I'm glad that the teen screen issue is out of this bill, and I will discuss that later in another committee. So I'll confine my comments to the language about children at risk for mental illness on lines 1010 and 1015, or I'm sorry, 1010, 1011, and then the mental health screening on 1015, as well as the MFIP pilot project on Article 3, Section 9. And the reason we're concerned about these provisions are numerous. First of all, lack of science and medical consensus for the criteria of the actual disorders, especially in young children, much less for being at risk, when at risk is not defined in the bill, or the types of questions that appear on mental health screening instruments. The U.S. Surgeon General, the World Health Organization, the National Center for Early Childhood Health Policy, the Chief of Child Psychiatry at the National Institutes of Mental Health, psychiatric textbook authors, and the authors of Psychiatry's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual all admit problems with the diagnostic criteria themselves, again, much less the screening instruments. Number two is the very high false positive rates. The instrument often used in young children is the ages and stages instrument, and its positive predictive value is only 23%, which means that for every 23 children correctly identified by these supposedly, these admittedly vague criteria, 73% are told that something is wrong with them that is not true. So that is a huge concern. Consent issues for screening. Yes, the MFIP program requires written consent, but it's not informed consent regarding what will happen with that data, how they were deemed to be at risk in the beginning, and unfortunately, a lot of this data stays around for a very long time. The over-identification and the overuse of psychotropic medication, particularly in poor and minority children, is a very big problem. First of all, just the implication of assuming that children of parents that are receiving MFIP benefits are more prone to a mental illness raises stigma concerns, if nothing else. The NAACP, in their support of an anti-coercion bill, mentioned a study from New York saying that minority male students are 11 times as likely to be on psychotropic medication as white students. new research found steep increases in the use of most classes of medicines, including psychotropic drugs, particularly the antipsychotic medications, and these were great increases in children on Medicaid compared to children in HMOs. And foster children, studies from Texas, Florida, and Massachusetts found between 50% and 65% of foster children are on one and sometimes as horrendously many as 12 different psychotropic medications starting as young as age 3. This type of thing really needs to be looked at. There are 2.5 million children in this country on and antipsychotic medications, which are the most potent. Youngest in that study from Vanderbilt being 18 months old. Another review of the side effects of these medications found 45 deaths in children. The youngest being 4 years old was Rebecca Riley from Massachusetts, who was diagnosed with bipolar disorder at age 28 months, was on 3 different medications, including antipsychotics, died of the side effects, and her parents are now being charged with murder in that death. And the FDA admitted that 45 probably represents between 1 and 10% of the truly reported deaths. There are numerous studies, which I won't go through now, on the lack of effectiveness and safety of the psychotropic medications in children, which this kind of unscientific screening will just lead to more of. There's cost issues. And the third handout that I gave you has some graphs of the Medicaid costs of psychiatric drugs in Texas and Florida. We're talking 30% increases per year in Florida and doubling, tripling, and quadrupling of costs in for just 4 drugs in Texas. And then there's the issue of autism. Now, autism is becoming one of the big reasons to screen children at a young age, yet this legislature, who has wisely banned mercury thermometers and wisely banned mercury emissions from manufacturing facilities, still allows the injection of mercury into the developing nervous system of infants and toddlers. So if we were dealing with the mercury issue, we would probably have to do a lot less screening for autism. I'd be happy to answer questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Ephraim. Are there any questions for the witness? If not, thank you for your
Madam
testimony.
Chair, okay. One question.
Senator Dahl.
Doctor, which section specifically are you talking about? These drugs, is there one like the MFIP program? You said that you're going to be affected by these drugs that you mentioned.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, my concern is that screening based on admittedly vague and not agreed upon criteria will increase the use of these psychiatric drugs. There are already studies to say that 9 out of 10 children that see a psychiatrist end up with a prescription for medication. And as I mentioned, there's the 2.5 million children on psychotropics or antipsychotics already, and 10%, according to the FDA hearings, on the Ritalin drugs of boys are on stimulants. So we already have very high rates of use, if not overuse, of these psychiatric drugs in children with dubious effectiveness and safety. And these kinds of screening programs will only increase that problem.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Ephraim. Senator Marty, I guess we're running out of time, so if members of the committee have more questions to Senator Marty, we're going to try to do this quickly, and then you're going to move to present your motion. Senator Worgen.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I don't know how I can do this real quickly, but the part of the bill that causes me the greatest concern is Section 6 of Article 3, beginning on page 16, verse 2.21. Anyone who has served on a committee with me where you start talking about socio-emotional screening is cringing in the audience right now because they know what I'm going to say. It raises just tremendous red flags with me anytime we start doing socio-emotional screening on kids kind of on a wholesale basis. And that's a little bit what this is. It's wholesale socio-emotional screening just because a family is part of a government program. I think it borders on being invasive, discriminatory. It raises just tons of huge red flags for me. And I know these young ladies at the table are going to disagree very strongly, and I respect that. But I don't care what anyone says. When we started running kids through the testing mill for ADD and ADHD, we started out handing Ritalin out like candy to little kids. We no longer could have naughty little boys or naughty little girls. We had to have kids on pills because they had to have a diagnosis. And that is somewhat, and really, folks, that is what the screening ends up doing. It ends up labeling kids, and it ends up putting them on drugs. It really does. I don't think anyone can deny that. The statistics are out there that show that that's what it does. And I don't think the government should be in the business of wholesale socio-emotionally screening children just because they're participating in a government program. That scares the wits out of me.
This is Andrea Ayers with Family and Children Service again.
Yes.
And I understand Senator Worgen's concerns. We've had this discussion before. With the article in this bill, I would suggest that it is not wholesale screening. In fact, it is offering parents, basically having a conversation with parents, that if you are struggling to find employment or keep employment or go through your training program or abide by any of the other rules on MFIP, and if you're having trouble doing that and you're receiving sanction or whatever is going on, if there is a problem with your child, let's talk about it. And if you think that there is something going on with your child that's preventing you from being successful, this is an opportunity to look at it. It's not going to force them to look at it. They don't have to do it. They can say, absolutely not, my kid's fine. Or maybe my kid is having trouble and I still don't want to look at it. That's fine too. It's completely voluntary. It is just opening up a discussion and offering help where help is needed.
Thank you. Senator Worgen.
It sounds so simple and so harmless when you say it. I understand what you're saying, Ms. Ayers. I do, but I absolutely cannot agree with you. It is not harmless. And it's any social worker out there that's working with an MFIP family can already talk to these parents about their children and all of the things that are happening. But you enter a new world when you start socio-emotional screening, when you start testing for what someone might potentially think is an emotional or a mental illness. And oftentimes what I've found when I've looked around and asked around is that very unqualified persons are giving this test, persons who do not have the background or the criteria of a psychologist or a psychiatrist or someone like that. And they're making suggestions to parents that I think are inappropriate for the medical knowledge that they have. And, you know, every parent wants their child to be a good little Johnny or a good little Susie. But you know what? Some of those naughty little Johnnies and Susies are the most delightful little Einsteins in the world. And we need to value them. We need to let them have some fun. We need to let them be a little bit naughty once in a while. And we need to stop shoving pills at them. And I just have to say that very strongly.
I would just like to offer one more comment about, I don't know that we'd have time to get into the whole protocol of screening instruments. I know the ASQSC, the Ages and Stages Social Emotional Questionnaire, has been brought up. That's used with the younger kids. Despite what previous testimony has indicated, these tools are valid. They are reliable. They've been scientifically studied. Just for an example, the ASQSE, I've got the numbers in my office. I didn't bring them. I didn't realize we were going to have this discussion today, but I could share those with the committee. That's a tool that has been approved by the Department of Education, the Department of Human Services, the Department of Health. And tools that are used for the older kids are only approved by the commissioner of the Department of Human Services if they have been proven to be valid and reliable and gone through all the scientific rigmarole, which I'm not a scientist, so I can't explain it all. But
thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Worgen.
I am compelled, seriously, to offer a verbal amendment, if I may.
Senator Marty, are you okay?
Madam
Senator Worgen.
Madam Chair, I would suggest on page 16, line 33, and on page 17, line 3, that we strike the words social and emotional. It still allows for developmental screening. Children and their parents and their workers can still have the discussions, but it strikes the word social and emotional for screening.
Okay. Senator
Madam
Marty.
Chair, I understand the amendment. I don't support it. Again, I think the issue is we're not talking. Sometimes there are kids who aren't being naughty but who have some serious problems. And again, many people who are on MFIP have disabilities, serious ones of their own, often chemical use, often mental health issues of their own. And the idea that we're going to say they can't connect families with appropriate social-emotional screenings and services, it seems to be taking some situation where even the parent recognizes there's a problem there and saying we're not going to connect you with any service. I understand your point. I guess I disagree with it because I think it's important that we do raise those issues. If the parents are willing to, if the parents see, you know, if there's been domestic abuse in the home, they can see what's happened to their kids, and they sometimes may want to have somebody tell them, here's how you connect with some help.
Okay, I guess we should take a vote. Senator Prentice-Allen.
I would just, Madam Chair, I would just like to speak on behalf of not eliminating those terms. They aren't just terms. They're part of the an integrated whole, and they address the makeup of the person, and you can't really just do a developmental assessment. You need to do a complete developmental social emotional assessment.
Is there any further discussion on the amendment? If not, all of those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No. I guess the amendment did not pass.
Madam Chair, I'd like a division, please.
Okay. So do we I present again? Okay. So all of those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Raise your hand.
Sorry. Sure. Those opposed? Did you count?
It didn't count.
Okay. The amendment didn't pass. Right? Okay.
It did not pass.
Thanks. Excuse me about that. Senator Martin.
Chair, I'm happy if there are other amendments or other discussion or whatever. Otherwise, I think this bill has to go to at least a couple more committees.
Okay.
So I will move the bill. I'll move Senate File 148 as amended, be recommended, pass, and refer to the Committee on Judiciary, I believe, to be the next step.
Is that correct? Okay. All of those in favor of the amendment, please say, in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Those opposed?
Aye.
The motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And I'll just restate one more time, if anyone's interested in going on the tour of the homeless facilities this evening, there is still room available.
Okay. Did you all hear this? Any other announcements from the committee?
Yeah.
If not, this meeting is adjourned.